I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners, especially relevant today, because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive writing. upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Steve McLaughlin, poet, audiographer, scholar of phonotextuality, sound editor, editor indeed of 71 previous episodes of Poem Talk, and soon to be editor of this, the 72nd, creator and producer of Into the Field podcast series for Jacket 2, founder and co-producer of Penn Sound Radio, curated 24/7 streaming, and TA and audio maestro of ModPo with its mere 36,000 students. And by Danny Snelson, editor of Ubu Editions at UbuWeb, contributing editor at Penn Sound, curator of the innovative Edit series here at the Writer's House, the reissues editor for Jacket 2, who cares passionately about the digital archive, digital editions, incredible machines, flash artifacts, radio poetics, and maybe most of all, databases. And by Jaap Blanc, the Jaap Blanc, Dutch avant-garde composer and performance artist, sound poet, visual performer, for whom Kurt Schwitters was an important influence, who has memorized all of Ursonate, whose live performances, which have to be seen and heard to be believed, entail phonetic language pieces, clicks, hisses, grunts, vocal manipulations of every sort mixed with humor, perfect imitation, and improvisation, whose discography is long and includes, in 2012, Traces of Speech. Welcome back to the Writer's House, Jaap.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's great. Danny, Steve,
yeah.
How's everybody?
Good. Doing well, thank you.
Good. So here we go. We're here to talk about Bob Cobbing, the British sound, visual, concrete, and performance poet, and in particular his piece Portrait of Robin Crozier, which is available at Penn Sound's Cobbing page and also on UbuWeb, but also on the Green Computer album, which was released in 1988. Another recording, which is longer than the Green Computer version we will hear and discuss, is dated 1976. And the second performer you'll hear is Hugh Medcalf. So here now is Bob Cobbing performing Portrait of Robin Crozier. First, Jaap, just to the virtuosity, how difficult is it to do that? I think some listeners will probably think, oh, he's just laughing or something, I can do that. Is that difficult to do?
I think it wasn't difficult for him. I think he'd been performing like this for a long time when this was recorded. But I think the ease and... comes from performing a lot. I don't think personally that Bob Cobbing ever practiced the voice.
He never practiced; he just performed it. What? Just a follow up question for you, Jaap. What physically is happening to his mouth and voice when he's doing some of those sounds?
I think it sounds like a natural vibrato that he developed. But it's totally possible that it's a manual vibrato, like when you
manipulate with your fingers,
the glottis with your fingers, like. It could also be that.
Can you do that? Do you have a natural bravado that
not so strong? No,
not as strong.
No, not as strong as that.
Can you do it for a few seconds? Can you try a natural vibrato?
But it goes also into what is a not a vibrato, but a tremolo, like that.
What did you I could listen to him all day. Forget about the rest of us. Danny and Steve, you in turn, Danny first. What did you hear in this Cobbing piece? What did you hear?
Oh, so many things. I mean, first, the laughter, which it's appropriate. We're all laughing as well. I was reading about the sonic structure of laughter as a kind of punctuation effect. So it punctuates speech. You can't speak and laugh at the same time.
You mean you can't say words and laugh at the same time?
Exactly, right. Yeah. But the sonic structure of it is that you have these short vowel sounds repeated every 210 milliseconds on average. And the science of laughter is really super interesting.
You mean you can only do a consonant for so long, it has to resolve into vowel?
Yes, I think that's the science. That's what they say.
Yep, you know this not to be true from practice?
I responded to the challenge of making a long P like this, and you could consider that a vowel, but I don't know.
I don't think you would.
You stand corrected. What else did you hear, Danny?
Aside from the laughter, there's a guitar, a bit of a drum, a hi-hat, maybe a kazoo. Maybe one phrase, placed it, perhaps.
Yeah, I heard that too.
I can't quite tell. Yeah.
There's some kind of function generator. There's a beeping, like a Morse code.
Was that what that was?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering what it was. It could also be a guitar played right at the top.
Yeah, it's possible. But, it's possible. Yeah. It seems quite regular.
But it sounds more electronic.
And elsewhere on that album, you can hear somebody, either Hugh Metcalf or Cobbing, playing with the function generator and jamming a little bit more and playing with the frequency wheel.
That sound, they're 9 beeps, and they come right at the middle of the track, which is at the middle of the Green Computer record, which seemed somewhat significant. However, I think that the most interesting sound was just the record itself. You hear all kinds of pops and hisses and crackles.
In the version that was played to create the pen sound recording? You hear the scratches of the vinyl?
Right, which is how it was originally recorded, which I think has an interesting relationship to the score of the poem as well.
Now, there is a score, right? So to what extent, and we can ask Jaap this about his own performance, but to what extent does Cobbing stay with the score? To what extent does he improvise from it? To what extent does he just turn away from the score? Steve, your thought on this?
Well, every one of Cobbing's interpretations of a score involve some sort of improvisation. There's a video interview with him on Ubu Web in which he talks about performing stones. A jagged stone has a much more, a discontinuous sort of performative quality, and a smoother is more, it's a more undulating, euphonous sort of rhythm. as with many of his pieces, this one looks like ink blotches. There's a kind of somewhat Madonna-like figure with a kind of unicorn-like splotch above her head or its head.
So we'll try hard to, for the program notes that go with this poem talk, we'll try hard to reproduce the score. But the score is a piece of artwork, would you say?
Yeah, indeed. It was produced for a gallery show put together by Robin Crozier, which became a book.
Are you saying that he looks at that and performs, he reads that music, yes? Or is that too strong?
That's my understanding, and it's open to many interpretations, obviously.
Jaap, tell us about scoring. Do you score everything that you do?
No, I don't. There's also pieces I memorize or that are improvised or have improvised sections. Mm-hmm. But I use many ways of scoring also, including sometimes traditional music notation, graphic scores, and my own extended version of the International Phonetic Alphabet. But I also particularly like, and I also work with this in workshops, to draw any kind of sign and then try to answer the challenge of interpreting that in sound, or vice versa, making some sound and then representing that with a sign of
afterwards.
Someone's own invention.
Yeah. Ah, so sometimes the score is an after effect of what you did, of your performance.
Yeah.
This is a portrait. This is a provocative title for this, for a piece like this, particularly for those who are listening to this conversation who don't know this kind of sound work. So let's go around all three of you. Danny first. Why? How is this a portrait? Why is this a portrait? Who is Robin Crozier? Say anything about that.
Sure. To start with, Robin Crozier is a male artist who commissioned...
M-A-I-L.
Yes.
Right?
Both males.
Both males. Right. Fluxus. There's an affiliation with Fluxus.
Right. A Fluxus male artist who sent out a commission, lived in Sunderland in a very remote area, so he didn't meet a lot of his collaborators and his socio-poetic network. However, he asked them all to create portraits of him. So they all sent in these portraits. This is Bob Cobbings. Of course, it uses a spirit duplicator, which is something that a kind of mimeograph machine, probably a Gestetner, that uses a kind of gummy ink. So you can see the mechanical process happening in Bob Cobbing's portrait.
So Cobbing responded to Crozier's call for portraits of the commissioner of the artwork, Crozier, and he used his, it was a very old mimeo machine, probably a Gestetner. I mean, he had a very old one, and he was able to learn how to manipulate that so that it blobbed. And then the sound performance comes from that later, so it's originally a visual or concrete thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of that work that Bob Cobbing did came out of his Writers Forum publications and his intimate working with ink on paper. Lawrence Upton describes this process as slow, very smelly, possibly carcinogenic, and unpredictable.
He's so, almost referring to the mimeograph machine.
Yes, the machine, but so that process is built into this object that he's later reading in the performance we just heard.
Okay, so that's great background. It doesn't answer the question, how is this a portrait? But that's actually the reason why we're having this poem talk, so we'll get to that eventually. Steve, any thoughts on this?
Well, no one involved in this, in the 100 Portraits of Robin Crozier project, had met him, at least the vast majority of them hadn't met him. So these are portraits of him, in a sense, portraits of some element of his...
Some absent figure.
Right, yeah. Precisely. So in this case, I mean, I hear childlike glee. I mean, it's laughter. It's the sort of pre-linguistic, pre-hierarchical sort of stuff that Cobbing was into, and which he shared in his sensibility with Robin Crozier.
Yup. Do you want to take a shot at this? How is this a portrait?
Oh, I think it's. I suppose they were friends, Cobbing and Robin Crozier, and it's a very affectionate, direct. Utterance towards a friend also, I think.
So there is some kind of semantic sense in this gesture of friendship, laughter meaning either the hilarity that you suggested or just the delight of a tribute to a friend. Is that might be the meaning?
I sense that in it too, yeah.
Okay, so Danny, back to you. So we're back to this question of, I'm not one of those skeptics, but there are surely people who listen to Poem Talk regularly and who appreciate the fact that we often we'll talk about a poem where there's a text and there's at least some semantic meaning, and we will force some sense of an interest in the form. Here we're really somewhat at sea if you're looking for some kind of conventional discussion about what it means. So in what way, now let's respond to that imagined skeptic. In what way is this really a portrait? How can one make noise and it serve as a portrait?
Well, their relationship was a textual and a material one, right? So he's making a portrait of the only relationship he may have with Robin Crozier by putting ink on a page, by reading that out in a performative fashion, by sounding the imagined exchange that he could have had. But if you can only have that exchange through these blots on a piece of paper.
Interesting. Any thoughts?
Well, I think so many artists have made... images, pictures, or even objects, non-figurative things, and named it a portrait of so-and-so.
Iris Clert, if I say so. A portrait of Iris Clert, if I say so, the famous Rauschenberg telegram. Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, and you can indeed go back to Gertrude Stein's portrait of Picasso is not a depictive presentation of what Picasso looked like. It was doing what Picasso does in words. It was trying to do the cubism in words. Steve, your thought on this?
Well, I think it comes down to what Danny just said, Rauschenberg said, which is because I say so. I mean, Cobbing could say any, assign any of his works to some particular occasion or some person or what have you, and he was incredibly prolific. So we just have his word to go on.
If I may just add one last thing to the question of portrait, I mean, there is a kind of figuration to the portrait, though. It's not quite so abstract, and I think with a lot of Cobbing, you have this great tension between figuration and abstraction, and it seems like it is kind of a figure, but then you realize it's just ink blots, but then those ink blots look like a figure again. So there's this sort of murky liminal space that it's operating in, which mm-hmm. I think is really interesting.
Yop, can I get you to react to something Cobbing said? This is, I think we've all heard it, but I'm just going to quote it. He said, Leonardo da Vinci asked the poet to give him something he might see and touch and not just something he could hear. Sound poetry seems to me to be achieving this aim. Does this make sense to you? And if so, what does it mean?
Oh, yeah, totally. And, what Cobbing added was also a poetry that you could smell very strongly. I remember I paid one visit to him in his house in London in 1994, and there was barely any room to move between the big stacks of paper of his books and books he was in the process of making, but all smelling very, very, very strongly of ink. Yeah.
Steve, let me try another Cobbingism on you.
Sure.
Communication is primarily a muscular activity. Say soma hyoma, dull. Say it dwelling on the quality of the sounds, soma hyoma. Better, let it say itself through you. Let it sing itself through you. The vowels have their pitch. The phrase has potential rhythms. You do it with the whole of you. Muscular movement, voice, lungs, limb. Poetry is a physical thing. Comment?
Soma hyoma. That's something that comes up again and again in Cobbing's writing, the interest in the material, either the material of the grain of the voice or the material of the ink on the page. something a little bit unsatisfying about that for me, I have to say.
Statement?
Yeah, the statement. It's almost, I mean, it becomes a kind of, I hate to use the word fetishization, but a fetishization of the minute constituent piece and the materiality, just people saying materiality over and over again. And that always sort of bugged me.
But Cobbing isn't guilty of that. Everybody else who's come along seems
well, Cobbing's just being himself. I can't fault him. And
yeah.
I don't know.
I assume, Yop, that you completely agree that communication is a muscular activity.
well, yeah. I think, yeah, some muscles have to be involved, and even in telepathy.
Danny, your thought on this?
On the muscularity.
Yeah.
I'm with Steve on the a kind of fetishization of materiality. And I think that for Cobbing, there is a way in which the materiality is trying to signify something. He talks quite a bit about achieving randomness, about beating a machine. He's always talking about it's the poet's job to defeat the machine, right? So a little grandiose, and maybe we could critique that as well. However, there is something beautiful in
what machine would he be defeating?
He's talking about the mimeograph, the Xerox, the
defeating
computer,
it, push
say.
It so hard that it gets pushed beyond its own category or something like that.
Right. He to give a brief quote, he says, it means giving it a little kick in the ribs. This is the machine. Giving it a little kick in the ribs from time to time and saying, come on, you can't get away with doing it exactly right every time. Let's have a little bit of wrong for a change. So I think a lot of his practice is about finding that little bit of wrong, which is particularly interesting when it's in the context of computers, which, are quite often quite mm-hmm. right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, didn't you say also that there's no use in adding anything to poetry that's already there? I think that's a quote of him also.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this aspect of there must be something wrong everywhere, and also the unpolishedness, so to say, the rawness of his work, that by being just himself, he was adding that thing to poetry that wasn't there yet.
Thank you. Jaap, can you describe a cobbing performance?
I've never attended one, so I've only heard recordings.
Mm-hmm.
So,
tell us a little more about your visit with him. What what do you get from cobbing? Why is cobbing important to you?
Well, he's totally original, and he makes a strong case for anarchism, I think. I think that's an aspect that's very, very present also in the performances. Yeah,
can you or anybody elaborate on anarchism here?
He did have radical political views. He was a conscientious objector from World War II, which is very rare, to say the least.
Almost no one in the UK.
Yeah, seriously. I think in my mind, this may be related to his upbringing. He was brought up as a member of the Brethren, which is a radically non-hierarchical Protestant Christian group, or they wouldn't call themselves a group. It was all about each community being self-governed. They were not just anti-papist, they were anti-bishop or any kind of hierarchy, which I think sort of fits into the aesthetic model that he ended up engaging in, and trading letters with people like Robin Crozier and doing these sort of, you know, very community-rooted DIY sorts of performances and publications.
So Cobbing is a political artist?
Yeah, sure, I'd say so.
How do we read the politics, Danny? I mean, Steve helped us by giving us some biographical context, and I'm completely convinced by it, by the way, but I'm still asking. How do you read the politics from a performance like this or from a series of performances, if you can?
Well, yeah, I think we have to go back and place it in its context. And Jaap, I think, is perfectly correct to locate it in a kind of punk rock aesthetic, which comes with, you know, as Greil Marcus reminds us, a kind of politics of anarchism as well. So both in 1976, but then again in 1988, you have this kind of refusal to perform it the same way. You hear the tracks are completely different. So each event is spontaneous. It's improvised. It's not predetermined by some semantic or, you know, overdetermined structure, which would be, you know, one of the core pieces to that kind of political perspective.
Do you want to take a shot at that question about politics of this work?
Well, this recording is obviously from the Thatcher era, and I think that made protest even more necessary. And I don't have enough of an overview of Cobbing's work, how it developed from the beginning until the later period. Not enough to speak about that. Maybe one of you can.
If I may,
elaborate
just
on that.
On
sure,
the Thatcher
Danny,
era, one of Bob Cobbing's favorite anecdotes was when the soon-to-be Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, encountered two of his paintings and was so disgusted by them.
Do you know?
At a national library, I believe, some library. She saw them and was so disgusted, she demanded that they be removed. When asked why, she said, "It's sperm." And he was thrilled by her response somehow that this life force of his work, his visual art, had so offended Margaret Thatcher that it had to be removed from the wall, which is the kind of, you know, provocation that artists might not so easily be able to achieve today as well.
Well, we could, the four of us, talk about Cobbing and about this kind of sound performance all day, but why don't I give everybody a chance to say one more thing about this performance or about Cobbing or about the field, anything at all, starting with Steve?
Sure. I guess I'll once again express a slight, I guess, ambivalence or reservation about this sort of work. There's something very cool about Cobbing's approach. When he was interviewed by Martin Spinelli on the program Radio Radio, a few questions popped out at me. He always gives the right answer. Martin Spinelli says, "Do you have a theory?" And Cobbing says, "No." And they talk about that. Spinelli says, "Do you write with the audience in mind?" And Cobbing says, "No." And then he elaborates on that at length. And Spinelli says, "Do you want to communicate anything?" And of course, Cobbing says, "No." And
that's not true.
Well, no, and I think that's demonstrably not true. But it's the right, you know, it's the right answer when you're in an interview. So that part of Bob Cobbing, I think it was fine for his time, but I feel like it may have that sort of cool approach may have outlasted its usefulness. Just from my perspective.
Wow. Okay.
Sorry.
There's a provocation, Danny. You want to pick up on that or go somewhere else?
I'll pick up on it a little bit, and I think I share a number of your reservations. So I'll find a redemptive note to end on, which has to do with the domestic aspect. One of the things that I admire is the way in which this mail art network that he was plugged into, constantly creating pamphlets, constantly working with material, it really achieved that avant-garde dream of using art in life in a way, right? But in a kind of domestic ambient sense. He was always making, he was always doing, he was always plugged into this network of practitioners. So that to me, I think, is quite beautiful. And I think that the poems have to be read in that kind of low level, you know, domestic activity.
And you'd say this piece we've been talking about is an instance of that.
Absolutely. It's an exchange between friends that incidentally happened to be performed. And he talks quite a bit about, you know, being a kind of incidental or, I forget the word, but...
Occasional?
Yeah. Yes. He talks quite a bit about his practice being occasional, that he performs and encounters works by happenstance. And so it's hard to put too much weight on any one of them. I think you have to really think about the full network that they're plugged into.
Right, and we have to apologize for the structure of Poem Talk, which inherently puts too much weight on a single piece. So I guess we'd urge everyone to listen to a lot of Cobbing. Jaap Blanc, a final word on any of this?
Yeah, I'd like to relate a personal anecdote. When at that same day in London that I had visited Bob at his house. He and Hugh Metcalf came to a performance I gave at a club called The Vortex, where I was playing with a performing with a Dutch pianist and cellist, and we did a program of sound poetry and 20th century music, often playing unrelated pieces together simultaneously. And at the culminating part of this performance, the most intense, the pianist was playing Mosolov's Iron Foundry piece. Maybe you've heard of it. Pretty noisy Russian piece. And the cellist was playing an early Hindemith etude, also a very wild piece. And I was performing Tristan Tzara's Brult sound poem, screaming at the top of my voice at some point. But during this part, Hugh Metcalf and Bob Cumming left the club. So I was kind of puzzled, and after a while they came back, and when our performance had ended, I asked them, didn't you like that part? Why did you leave? And they said, oh, no, we went to the pub across the street. The pint's cheaper there.
Did they like the performance?
They liked it a lot.
Oh, yeah. That's great. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us, and if the three of you are brief, all of us, to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. Steve, you look like you're ready to gather some paradise.
Sure. Since we're talking about a wildly prolific verbal artist, I thought I'd draw our listeners' attention to the recent release of a discography of the works of the rapper Lil B. You can find this at preservebasedgod.tumblr.com. It's a collection of over 50 albums and mixtapes. It's a total of 45 gigabytes, including all of Lil B's videos. And that was just released a few weeks ago. So Lil B for Lil Boss. Thank you, Based God.
Great. Thank you, Danny.
I'd like to plug Christopher Vandegrift, whose works I've been completely enthralled by. He's working here at Penn, doing fantastic things with media formats and plugging video games into audio files and vice versa. I think very much in the Cobbing spirit.
Great. Yep.
Oh, the first name that comes to my mind is Maya Jantar. I spell that M-A-J-A and then last name J-A-N-T-A-R. Woman living in Ghent, Belgium, from Polish origin, doing very beautiful voice work, sound poetry, and also visual work.
Great. Well, I'll recommend two things. One is the Jaap Blanc page at PennSound itself. And we'll make sure, if there's not one already there, that there is a link outward from that page to your other site so that people can not only listen to Jaap's recordings of his performances, but also find out where he's performing around the world. And the second shout-out is to PennSound Radio, which is constantly streaming And some of this kind of work is there mixed in with other kind of work. And Steve McLaughlin is its onlyest begetter. I'm not sure that's the right phrase, but he's the force behind it.
So.
Well, that's all the domestic ambient vibrato laughter we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk. Yes, laugh. That's exactly the right thing. Keep going and you'll be an artist. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Steve McLaughlin, Danny Snelson, and Yacht Blanc, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer today, Chris Martin, and to our editor, as always, the just-mentioned Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, Patrick Durgan, Tom Donovan, and Tyrone Williams will be here to join me in a discussion of an improvised word performance by Steve Benson. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for that or another episode of Poem Talk.